This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
As we are going, mega drought will be so common in some places that will be the new normal. In fact, scientists say we may already be there. Other parts of the world are changing toward extreme rains and floods over and over again. Worst of all, in a superheated future, extreme events like wildfires and floods can follow one another in quick succession, like a 1-2 punch. This is the new world we make by burning fossil fuels. We can find it all in New Science from University of California assistant professor and researcher Dr. Samantha Stevenson. She works with a small team of expert co-authors. Samantha Stevenson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, great. Yeah, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
You know, even before we get to this drastic new future, some other rude news has intruded. You were also a project scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. NCAR, as it's known, works to establish climate impacts, including fires. Recently, staff at NCAR were evacuated due to a nearby wildfire. It was called the NCAR fire. Is that ironic?
I suppose, but, unfortunately, it's something that is more and more to be expected. I watched the news very closely, the NCAR fire. A lot of friends of mine live in that neighborhood, and we've been seeing wildfire in Boulder more and more frequently over the past years as well.
Let's go to a new paper you led, published March 14th, 2022, in the prestigious journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The title is 21st Century Hydroclimate, a Continually Changing Baseline with More Frequent Extremes. What was the purpose of this study, Samantha?
Oh, sure. I guess the purpose of the study is suggested by the title, right? So we've known for a while that under climate change, under future projected warming, we expect significant trends in what we call hydroclimate, so like dryness and wetness, or the amount of moisture available in the soil. So what we wanted to know is, how do you incorporate our understanding of those trends when you're thinking about what constitutes a drought event? There's also been some previous work that suggests that, you know, these mega droughts, like sustained droughts that last for multiple decades, the risk of those will become almost 100% in the future. And what I wanted to say is that that is actually a consequence of just the background trend towards increasing dryness. And so one question that we wanted to answer is, has mega drought become normal? And if so, when? The result of that calculation was that mega drought has in fact already become normal in places like the Western U.S., Western Europe, Australia, and Southern Africa. And in other places, extreme wet conditions are becoming normal in places like India and Eastern Africa. So that was one question that we were trying to answer. And then the other thing that we wanted to do was to say, okay, what is a drought? Like, when the background state is changing underneath you, what does it even mean to be in a drought, which is usually something that we define as drier than normal, right? If normal is becoming drier, when do you then experience a drought? And so what we did with the climate models is said, okay, we have some idea of how fast normal is changing. Let's kind of correct for that and then see if we can do that, if the change between our new continuously changing normal and a drought event is actually any different. And we find that, in fact, it isn't. So basically, droughts themselves aren't changing that much, but normal is. Right, so these trends are huge, and so that means that we're going to have to continuously adapt to a state of normal that is becoming drier every year, at least in the Western U.S.
Listeners in the West understand the term megadrought too well, but I want to get to some of your new projections about megapluvials, and I don't think that's a term most people know. What is that?
You know, it's basically the opposite of a mega drought, right? So a mega drought would be typically a period where it stays drier than normal for multiple decades. Right? And so a mega pluvial is just the opposite, right? So instead of being drier than normal, you would be wetter than normal for, in this case, like 15 years or so.
Well, last October, northern China was struck by extreme rains for days on end. According to communist newspaper Shaanxi Evening News, 190,000 hectares or 470,000 acres of cropland was flooded and wrecked It's another blow to global wheat stocks. Chinese scientists do blame climate change, and they wonder if it's the new normal there. Is that a pluvial event, or is it something that has to take over a longer period to qualify in your study?
Well, that's an interesting question. So our study actually looked at a couple of different timescales. So this mega drought, mega pluvial thing I've been talking about, that's more of like a slow variation, or like a low frequency. So just like on average, the amount of moisture that's changing over a long period of time. That's this mega drought, mega pluvial. And I think what you're talking about in the Chinese context, or what we is more of like a seasonal thing. Like it's like it was a really wet year, or there was a series of extreme rainstorms. And so we thought about that in our study as well. And it looks like if you think about just, you know, having a really wet winter, for example. So we said, like, are there 90-day periods where it's just super wet? And in fact, yes, there certainly are. That's just expected without climate change to begin with. But now that climate change is happening, those wet years are expected to become even wetter as well. So even in places where you're seeing this trend towards drier and drier and drier conditions in general, you can have particular wet years that become even wetter, and they're kind of punctuating that increased dryness.
I think the question you worked on is a little bit difficult to comprehend at first, but it's important, and that is, will the extremes be even more extreme, or will they not really seem that way because the normal is extreme? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, kind of. Right? Humans were able to adapt to a lot of different things, right? And our idea of what is normal in a lot of different contexts can change from year to year. We see that with, like, technology improvements, with some different political types of changes, right? And so we wanted to say, like, is that true for hydroclimate as well? Right? And so, yeah, so if your idea of normal is just continuously changing, then what you're actually kind of sensing as if you're trying to, say, manage water or something like that, you're dealing not with what was normal 50 years ago, but what is normal now, right? And so that's kind of the hopeful message of our study is saying, yeah, like, once we can get our heads around this idea that, like, we have to adjust to normal changing underneath us, the variability, like, those high frequency, those individual years and things like that, like, those are something that maybe we could manage for more effectively. That's not going to change as much.
Your team finds almost two-thirds of Earth's habitable land surface will experience either drought or extreme wetting. Could those extremes last for decades, or would they be permanent in human timescales? What do you think?
So it looks like that 60% of the land surface where that signal we call emerges from the noise, that is going to essentially mean that either mega drought or mega pluvial or extreme wet conditions, those just, like, we don't come back below that threshold. So that's why we're essentially in a permanent mega drought in the western U.S.
Wow. Well, Samantha Stevenson, you began your scientific studies as an astronomer. Astronomers need to be time travelers in a way because they're mapping light from distant stars that was emitted a long, long time ago. Do you think that perspective helps you construct a future for this planet now that you're in climate research?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think so. I think it's helpful to have a long-term perspective in general. Right. So, yeah, as an astronomer, you tend to think more in, the millions of years or billions of years kind of time scale. Right. So what is the fate of the universe kind of thing? And from that perspective, like, you know, climate change is certainly bad. It is certainly having a lot of negative consequences everywhere in the world. But I tend to look at it as, like, we will adapt. Right. The Earth will be okay. It's just, what is society going to look like when we get to whatever state we eventually stabilize at, right? And so we're not there yet. We're in a time of transition. But my hope is that by understanding, like, how this climate variability and these types of impacts respond to long-term changes in climate, then we can be more prepared and we can, you know, be ready for the Earth that we will have once we eventually stabilize our CO2 emissions.
Well, this PNAS paper finds mega drought already developing in the southern United States and northern Mexico, in the Amazon, the majority of Europe, and southern Africa. But long-lasting drought may appear in other surprising places in coming decades, like northern Canada. I never would have guessed that one.
Yeah, that's true. That's one that I was not expecting either. And so that'll be interesting to watch. I mean, that seems to be like some of these places are places where we had a lot of snowpack persisting throughout the year. And so maybe part of that is that we're just seeing some melting of that. We haven't looked at the high latitudes in as much detail yet. But yeah, it'll be interesting to try to think about those as well.
Did you find the appearance of some megapluvial events might be delayed until later in this century? And if so, why?
Yeah, so the megapluvial emergence does seem to be somewhat later than the emergence of the mega drought. So like it takes longer for wetter conditions to become normal, essentially. I'm guessing that that has to do with the drivers of those trends, right? So in a lot of places where it's drying out, that the reason why it's drying is because of temperature, right? So we're very sure that the land surface is warming rapidly, it's warming consistently over a lot of places, and all the climate models agree on that. And with rain, it's a little more complicated. There's a lot more variability in rainfall. Like the different climate models tend to agree less well on the exact details of it. And so that means that like statistically, it might take us longer to be sure that we can detect a change that's outside of what we would consider normal now. And so I would think that that would be why that kind of that emergence time or like the year in which we can be sure we're no longer coming back to normal.
On our current greenhouse path with the high emissions, and you do assume that in the paper, the new normal for almost a third of settled Earth is really a new extreme pattern. In fact, your paper says, quote, the entire 21st century is identified as a single large event. Could you explain what that means?
I'm calling it a single large event because it would be if you defined your event as any time where you're below an absolute threshold. In the past, we have defined a mega drought as any period where the soil moisture is below a certain level, right? And that certain level is defined based on what normal was over the past, say, 30 years, okay? And the trouble is that we are in this situation where climate change is happening. We have a continuous trend towards drier and drier and drier conditions in the Western U.S., right? And so if you have a static threshold, if you're saying it has to be below, I don't know, -1, let's say, just to make up a number, right? But you're subtracting 1 from that amount of moisture every year. But yeah, you're always going to be below -1 because you keep subtracting from it, right? And so that's why we wanted to say that's not at a certain point very useful anymore, because we know that we're always going to be in a drought because we decided what a drought was 50 years ago, right? And so that's what we were trying to do with this paper is to say, okay, well, like, what is a more useful definition of drought? A more useful one would take into account the fact that we are continuously changing the amount of moisture that's available in the soil. And what we care about is just the deficit relative to what we expect it would be normal for right now.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest scientist Samantha Stevenson from the University of California, Santa Barbara. We're talking about extreme weather events as the new normal. We could talk about Australia, Southern Europe, and many places, but let's move to a classic case of extremes with your latest paper, released April 1st, Climate Change Increases Risk of Extreme Rainfall Following Wildfire in the Western United States. That paper is led by Danielle Tuma at NCAR, and you are co-author. What was your goal with this paper?
Yeah, so our goal with this paper was to understand not only the risk due to one type of extreme, but the risk due to multiple things happening at once. So, Danielle was in my lab at UC Santa Barbara when we started this work, and we got really interested in this because in Southern California and in Colorado, where she now is based, you see both wildfires and extreme rainfall. And if both of those, if you have a fire and then a rainstorm immediately afterwards, when the vegetation hasn't had a chance to regrow or anything like that, then you can have really severe impacts. In Montecito, California, just down the road from us in Santa Barbara, actually this happened in 2018, and many people died. It was one of the most destructive fires in Southern California history at the time. And so we wanted to say, okay, well, we have these great modeling tools, and we know that both the climate change is going to increase both the risk associated with wildfires and the frequency of extreme rainfall. So you would think that the risk of both of those happening in rapid sequence would also increase. And we can actually quantify that using these large sets of model simulations that we have. And so we said, well, let's do that. And in fact, the risk of those, what we call compound extremes, does get magnified kind of by an enormous amount in some parts of the Western U.S.
In 2021, my home province of British Columbia in Canada shared the intense heat dome and multiple giant wildfires that were found in the Pacific Northwest, Washington State, and Oregon. Then just 2 months after that provincial fire emergency was lifted in September, we were hit with unbelievable amounts of rain. All highways, rail connections to the rest of Canada were cut off by landslides and floods. Is that an example of the kind of events that you studied in this paper?
Yeah, I suppose it would be. So we were looking at compound extremes, but the particular index that we were using is a little bit different from the heat dome. It's the only reason that I hesitate, right? So we were looking at, to represent the weather conditions that would be associated with wildfire, using this thing called the fire weather index that takes into account both temperature, humidity, and winds, and things like that. So I would think that the heat dome events would have had a pretty large fire weather index value. I just don't know what that was specifically for that event. But these types of swings between super hot and dry conditions and, as you said, unbelievable amounts of rain is exactly the type of thing that we were interested in. And it does look like it will become quite a bit more frequent in the future.
Well, it's weird because extreme rains tend to do worse damage after a fire when the fire might be up in the mountains. Cities downstream can be flooded out and debris can collect in the rivers and damage fisheries, all sorts of things. It's strange that the post-flood zone is bigger than the post-fire zone in some cases.
Yeah, and that's kind of one example where the net effect of two extremes happening in rapid sequence can be a lot more destructive than what would happen if each of them had happened individually. And part of the reason why it's important to try to use these large global data sets to try to say, what is the actual spatial pattern of both the impact of both the events individually and their sequence.
You know, we never heard the term atmospheric river in TV weather talk until a few years ago. Are there more of them, and what can we expect in coming decades? Is that part of this flood-after-fire picture?
It is. Yeah, we didn't look at atmospheric rivers specifically in any of our papers, although I would imagine that the extreme rainfall events that we see are often associated with atmospheric rivers. We just weren't looking for those circulation patterns specifically. In California and, in the Pacific Northwest as well, a lot of the most extreme rainfall events have to do with the landfall of atmospheric rivers. Atmospheric rivers are going to become able to carry a lot more moisture in the future. So when they do make landfall, they are, just because of the warming of the atmosphere and the ability of warmer air to hold more moisture, that means that when these things hit, then they will pack a lot more of a punch in the future.
I was surprised to learn that the flood doesn't have to follow the fire just a few months later. It can be longer than that. How long is that delay factor where floods might hurt an area even though the fire was sometime previous?
Yeah, I think that's an important question, and I think it probably depends on where you are and what kind of impact you're worried about, right? So if you're particularly concerned about debris flows or landslides specifically, then that the largest risk there is within the first year after a wildfire, because then after that, the kind of chaparral-style vegetation that we get in Southern California, for example, has had time to regrow and reestablish some of the root zones, and so the risk of rapid erosion isn't as large, although it still is elevated relative to what it was for a few years. Even in that situation where you're not worried specifically about a debris flow, still the risk of larger than normal runoff can be a lot bigger even several years after a wildfire as well.
It kind of sounds like California might as well get ready for more and more of these compound strikes. Is that what you find, and how often might they come?
Yeah, it's exactly what we find. It's, don't really take much joy in reporting this, but it does look like this rapid succession, fire, weather, rainfall type of sequence is going to become fairly frequent in the future. It looks like the risk of that in, the majority of the Western U.S. will at least double by the end of the 21st century.
Do you think this study tells us something about places outside the Western U.S., like the Mediterranean or Australia?
It might. We haven't studied the variability of these extreme fire, weather, rainfall sequences in any other region yet. But, yeah, I would imagine that the drivers of these things are pretty robust in a lot of places, right? Like, we know it's getting warmer. We know globally the changes in extreme precipitation are also really reliable. So most likely, if we were to replicate this study in other Mediterranean climate regions, I would expect to see something similar. But, yeah, we would need to actually go through the exercise to be sure.
Samantha Stevenson, do you think there could be multiple extreme events in one year, like more than a 1-2 punch, but a series of blows? Is that possible?
It is possible, yeah, because these things are essentially like rolls of the dice. Right? We're not claiming that like extreme fire weather is causing rainfall, but extreme rainfall, but it just is going to happen by chance sometimes. So yes, it is definitely possible that as these extreme rainfall events themselves become more frequent, just statistically, you're going to get more years in which multiple rainfall events could follow a particular fire. And in fact, that is one thing that we've quantified in the study.
Science is getting a clearer and clearer picture of a new climate on this planet. Samantha, what are you working on next?
That's a great question. I'm working on a few things, and they're all kind of under the umbrella of understanding how climate variability will respond to climate change. So we're really interested in, say, like how El Nino events, so changes in variability in tropical Pacific Ocean temperatures will respond to climate change, and how that might drive some of these changes in atmospheric circulation that are associated with these atmospheric river events, so these wildfires. We're also interested in the impact in the ocean, too. Like we've got a whole theme of research that's going on trying to look at, say, how do heat waves in the ocean work and how do those respond to climate change. And it's another situation where if our idea of normal is continuously changing and you have superimposed on that just some amount of variability. So there's going to be shocks to many ecosystems and to human societies that we expect to intensify in the future.
Yeah, oceans cover most of the planet. I wonder if there will be sort of mega droughts and mega pluvials over the seas.
For a lot of like the marine applications, they're worrying more about like temperature and changes in ocean pH and the types of nutrients that are available in the ocean. But yeah, like I think there's a whole fascinating realm of compound extremes to be looked at in the ocean as well.
As we speak, listeners are struggling with a pandemic, war, and economic stress. How can we keep attention on the climate crisis with so much else going on? And personally, how do you keep going?
Yeah, I think that's another great question. And it's just, you know, I guess we should all kind of take a deep breath and recognize that we are dealing with a lot right now. And getting by in a world where we have to deal with so many both climate-driven and just societal challenges is kind of a big deal right now. I think that, yeah, what keeps me going is just to the idea that even though there is so much bad stuff going on in the world, like that it might be possible to try to use improved scientific knowledge to help us adapt to some of those things. And so I'm always trying to keep my eye on that and to try to say, okay, well, we're locked into a future where a lot of these impacts are getting worse, but at least we can try to be better prepared and to try to know that like life goes on, right? Like, humans are really resilient, and we are impressive in that sense. So just trying to stay positive as much as possible.
From the University of California, we've been speaking with Dr. Samantha Stevenson, and you can find links to these scientific papers in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Samantha, thank you for sharing your work with us.
Great. Yeah, thanks so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.